The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting our podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. Well, this is the second reading in March, or March 8th. We're reading about the Blowing Rock. How a landmark and a legend built North Carolina's first travel attraction. Pretty picture of the Blowing Rock with a young lady with a dog peering over the edge of it. And as a matter of fact, here she is again right on this article against a gorgeous blue Carolina sky for the article entitled The Blowing Rock, A Love Story. The caption on the picture, by the way, says, Leslie Restivo and her dog Cooper are part of a long tradition. For generations, the Blowing Rock has beckoned visitors to stand 3,000 feet above the Johns River Gorge and take in spectacular views. At more than a billion years old, this ancient outcrop captured human imagination, inspired a legend, and became the state's earliest travel attraction. Our fascination with the Blowing Rock endures and keeps drawing us west. Written by Joseph Bethanti. He has apparently dedicated this because at the top of the next page it says, For Patricia DeNino, my favorite aunt, who fondly remembers living in Blowing Rock when she was 4 years old. On my dusky inaugural trek to Blowing Rock some years back, I wended up and up U.S. Highway 321 north, along blade-thin switchbacks, hacked into the ever-increasing altitude, nothing but the flimsiest purchase on the quaking blacktop tethering me to earth. When, finally, I crossed the Eastern Continental Divide at 3,600 feet or so and reached Blowing Rock proper, coiling fog-cloaked Main Street, I spied the shrouded beacon of Tijuana Fats, since closed, and barged through its front door just in time for last call. The restaurant was abandoned, except for a few hangers-on and mop-up crew. The kitchen had closed, but I managed to score a beer, chips, and salsa. I sat brooding contentedly in my bright corner until I spirited out with the diehards. Beyond the threshold, the world had disappeared. Back on Main Street, I couldn't find my car. I couldn't find my hand. The impenetrable fog was a living thing, hauntingly cinematic. The seductive Moorish mist of Wuthering Heights. I'd entered a fable, stumbled through a magic portal, secreted in the ether into a tiny hamlet of romance and danger. I froze there on the sidewalk, wondering what in the world to do. The shops had long closed. The gauzy street lamps flickered anemically. I was lost. My invisible car, parked along the sidewalk curb, was but a few meters off, and I minced in what I hoped was the right direction. Finally, I discovered it, fired it up, and engaged the headlights. They'd proved useless, simply churning up roiling billows of relentless fog. Not a soul, not an automobile was around. Seemingly the only person left on earth, I motored blindly along, hopefully toward my lodging, at 2 miles an hour, a flashlight and my head dangling from my open window to locate the yellow bisecting line on Main Street, while the interior of the car pulsed with vapor. The next morning was glorious, blinding in an entirely different vein. The fog had not quite dissipated, but Rather, it transformed into swirling wreaths and buntings of alabaster down, regally scarving the distant ancient Appalachian peaks and ridges. I had to look away, shield my eyes, and the sun torched the heavens. Perhaps like that first storied morning recorded in Genesis, when light was first conjured. The illumination was that suddenly miraculous. Revelation often occurs at such magnificent altitude, and it is precisely why people are beckoned to places like Blowing Rock. One experiences, perhaps, a kind of hubris and insignificance simultaneously. You can see so far beyond the boundaries of self. The known world stretches miles and miles, counties and counties, and the beauty of that immensity is shocking, humbling, at times daunting. The firmament perches at the brim of your hat, but 12 inches from plummeting more than 3,000 feet, I stood that morning at the edge of an ancient stone ledge and gazed through the eye-level wisps of cottony pink fog shot with excelsior at the distant Piedmont. I had to back off. The proximity to heaven was a tad dizzying. The Blowing Rock itself, the village's namesake, is unassumingly grand, a gargoyle-like gneiss, a kind of straighted metamorphic rock, promontory that looms approximately 277 stories over John's River Gorge and affords the mythical view that, in truth, defies description. It is the proverbial wild blue yonder, the abyss, reminiscent of what the great poet Elizabeth Bishop in her poem The Fish calls the terrible oxygen. It is frighteningly exhilarating, a palpable adrenaline jolt. Standing in the void, you unequivocally reckon the electricity and grandeur of sheer altitude from your boot soles to the roof of your skull. Along the marbled amethyst chasm, Grandfather and Grandmother Mountains reassuringly preside, as well as a panorama that takes in Mount Mitchell, the highest peak in mainland eastern North America, and Table Rock, Hawksbill, and Beech Mountains. Since 1933, the Blowing Rock has been proclaimed North Carolina's oldest travel attraction. The complex features trails and gardens, an observation tower guaranteed to induce vertigo, where folks stage weddings choreographed quite literally in the clouds, the main buildings overflowing with gifts, souvenirs and memorabilia, an annex gift and snack shop, and a photo gallery and museum. An invaluable archive of truly fascinating vintage photographs and artifacts that brilliantly narrate the intrepid history of the Blowing Rock, but also of the idyllic Storybrook Village founded in 1889, christened after it. The site is still plenty wild. It's a precipice nearly 3 times taller than the Empire State Building. The U.S. Geological Survey believes that the Blowing Rock is roughly 1,055 million, that's more than a billion, years old. However, 2 decades into the 21st century, approaching its 90th anniversary since opening officially as a branded tourist destination, the site has definitely been tamed. Nevertheless, it's easy to imagine what it must have been like in the old days without the fences and rails and warnings in red bold to climb at your own risk. Those early photos in the gallery attest to the precarity. Folks teetering from the rock, perched in the troposphere, taking mad chances for immortality. One false step from kingdom come. There's an unforgettable daredevil shot of a chap, hands intrepidly on his hips, standing on what seems to be the seat of an early 20th century automobile, perhaps a Pierce Arrow. The car is parked astonishingly at 45 degrees on the rock itself. This very image appears in Donna Aker Warmoth's Blowing Rock, part of the Images of America series. It's actually an antique postcard with a 1910 postmark and a head note in the upper left corner, America's Switzerland, the unrivaled Blowing Rock country. The famous Blowing Rock altitude 4,090 feet near Blowing Rock, North Carolina. An earlier allusion to Wuthering Heights is anything but arbitrary. The story of the Blowing Rock, and by association, the eponymous village, is, after all, a love story rooted in lore and legend. The language describing the legend varies depending on the source, but I prefer, especially for an unapologetic sentimentality and swooning diction, the 152 words in greening bronze relief installed in the early 1970s. Pardon me, I had a sneeze there. At the site of the rock itself, it begins in the manner of fairy and tall tales. It is said, and goes on to recount, how a Chickasaw tribal chief, distraught over the white man's admiration of his beautiful daughter, journeyed from the plains and hid her atop a white, craggy cliff, in this case, the Blowing Rock, in the keep of her mother. There she remained, so reminiscent of the maiden in the tower, or damsel in distress archetype, cloistered for an indeterminate amount of time. One day she spied a Cherokee brave in the wilderness below and playfully shot an arrow at him, an unmistakable homage to Cupid, the winged Roman god of love and desire. Thusly summoned, the Cherokee man predictably appeared before her wigwam, and in the days that followed, they became sweethearts. Such romances are never without the requisite complications. In the very next sentence, we learn that one evening, a prophetic red sky beckoned him to return to his people. Again, I love the poetic schmaltz and stock melodrama. The lovely maiden begged him not to go. Being torn between his love for her and his duty to his people, he leaped from the rock into the ominous night. Utterly bereft, the young woman fell to her knees and prayed to the spirits for his return. Such lovelorn petitions in the medium of legend are always rewarded. This tale also harkens back to Penelope's mythical wait for Odysseus. Lo, a strange heavenward breeze blew her lover back onto her outstretched arms. This fantastically imaginative, compressed snatch of microfiction concludes appropriately with, "Since that day, this cliff with the mysterious upward winds has been known as the Blowing Rock." We can only surmise that they lived happily ever after, and only the most boorish of spoil sports would dare want more. I am not, I hope it is plain, that spoil sport. I admire this tale, this ample allegory, exactly as it is. In fact, I hope every jot of it is gospel truth. However, and of course, there exists a scientific explanation for the meteorological aberration upon which the story turns. The towering rock walls of the Johns River Gorge create a flume, a deep, slender channel through which the John River flows. The northwest wind discharges through that flume with such velocity that it gusts literally upwards, designating the Blowing Rock in a Ripley's Believe It or Not cartoon as the only place in the world where snow falls upside down. But let's tarry a moment, because there is indeed more. Just an inch or so beneath those 152 words rests a cameo-shaped bronze bas-relief, portraying the actual heart-rending reunion of those sweethearts. The Chickasaw woman, head-banded, long-haired, siren-like, indisputably beautiful, kneels in profile at the very edge of the Blowing Rock. The Cherokee man, in defiance of gravity, levitates in midair above her. His long hair is tied off with a feathered headband. Immortality. They clasp hands. All about them, like halos, swirl upraised ovals to mime the torrential winds, and what can only be a trinity of hovering birds conferring benediction. It is most remarkable, nothing short of authentic iconography. Yet there's something else, and there's no other way to say it. This portrait is rather risque, in truth eroticized. Neither sweetheart is, for the most part, clothed. They are breech-clouted at best, period. The artist who executed this bas relief, cast in a foundry in Charlotte and installed in the early 1970s, is the late Jack Pence Jr., a Korean War veteran, who also designed Land of Oz on Beach Mountains. Astoundingly, Pence has extrapolated his bold vision of the sweetheart's tryst solely from the text of the story. The author of the original text, purportedly penned in the late 1800s, before that it surely was passed down in the signature oral tradition of Appalachia, remains anonymous. Likewise, the more recent 152-word version in bronze in the Blowing Rock was, again, purportedly adapted and rewritten in the 1920s by an anonymous woman who lived near Camp Yonalusley. Mired as it is in the apocryphal, the legend of the Blowing Rock is burnished with even more allure and mystery. Interestingly, that language in bronze is slightly edited in the Legend of the Blowing Rock section of the brochure available at the Blowing Rock's gift shop. In it, there is but a lone white man in admiration of the young Chickasaw woman. The Cherokee man, at the behest of the woman's flirtation, not only answers the overture of that fateful arrow, but also courts her with songs of his land, and they become lovers, wandering the pathless woodlands and along the crystal streams. The image of two lovers in the brochure and on the large sign on 321 at the intersection of the Rock Road, directing folks to the Blowing Rock, has been appreciably toned down to accommodate a G rating. The woman still kneels on the rock. The man still floats in midair above her. Their hands are still locked. A massive falcon beats beneath them in the glowing orange and yellow sunset sky. But they are rendered featureless, androgynous silhouettes, yet nonetheless elegiac. All that longing, the timeless wiles of love at dizzying altitudes, forever intact. Forever. The writer is Joseph Bathanti, former poet laureate, as if you can't tell by all of the elaborate words he uses, of North Carolina, and recipient of the North Carolina Award in Literature, teaches at Appalachian State University. The Blowing Rock is in Blowing Rock, North Carolina, and they're on the web at theblowingrock.com. There's a couple of sidebars here. One says, take a trip. There's a picture of the Blowing Rock Market, which is a stacked stone building with a modern set of windows that we see here, very nice looking. With dozens of shops, inns, and restaurants within its compact downtown, Blowing Rock is a beloved mountain destination. Here are just a few of the many spots that make a vacation or weekend getaway memorable. Eat at Story Street Grill. The trout platter, made with local mountain fish, is the most popular dish at this Main Street restaurant. Diners also love the homey atmosphere, open kitchen, and friendly service. They're on Main Street, Stories Street Grill, with an L-E at the end, .com. So that's Story, I got to spell this one out, S-T-O-R-I-E, Street Grill, G-R-I-L-L-E, .com. Twig's Restaurant and Bar, offering locally sourced ingredients with a 9-page wine list. Twig's is a restaurant with two personalities, a cozy and romantic one in the dining room, casual in the separate bar area. We like the blend of fine dining and a fun bar that all the locals come to, says Doug Beach, who co-owns the restaurant with his brother David. They're on Valley Boulevard at twigsbr.com. You can shop at Art Walk. Every inch of floor and wall space in this boutique is filled with handcrafted artistic treasures, made locally or regionally, including leather journals bound in Valley Cruces, pottery from North and South Carolina, and nature photography of the Blue Ridge Mountains. They're on Main Street at artwalkstyle.com. Blowing Rock Market is located in a renovated 1950s gas station. The market offers a wide selection of local meats, cheeses, wines, and jams, plus house-made breads with a new patio, draft beers, and wines by the glass. The market has become a gathering place. Main Street, BlowingRockMarket.com. How about The Last Straw? The exposed beam cathedral ceilings at this must-stop home decor shop are holdovers from the building's earlier life as First Baptist Church. Built around 1923, the store's most popular items include wreaths, handmade by in-house designers, and Amish-made outdoor furniture. Main Street, The Last Straw Inc., INC.com. Sunset Teas and Hattery. This eclectic gift shop and ice cream parlor offers old-timey candy, classic drinks like knee-high and Dogs and Suds root beer, and the Wall of Heat, featuring local and hard-to-find hot sauces. Upstairs, there are T-shirts, toys, and hats, from toboggans to top hats. Main Street, no website. Sunset and Vine. One of owner Sharon Chrisman's goals is to make wines easily accessible in both price and flavor. The rotating featured flight at her wine shop and tasting room, a favorite of locals, includes four pours of whites and reds that tends to be milder, but bolder options are also available for those with an adventurous palate. They're on Sunset Drive and Blowing at BlowingRockWine.com. If you want to play, then go to the Blowing Rock Art and History Museum. Brahm exhibits tell the story of the rich cultural heritage of the area through art and craft work, from paintings to pottery to blown glass by regional makers. Upstairs, the screen door and a stool from Sonny's Grill, a town gathering place from 1945 to 2009, are displayed alongside a fragment of the billion-year-old Blowing Rock Gneiss. They're on Ginny Stevens Lane and BlowingRockMuseum.org. You can stay there at the Inn at Ragged Gardens. The original well of the circa 1900 house is used today to water the inn's scattered gardens, which feature centuries-old rosebuds and an array of tulips that pop up in the spring. The exterior columns and main staircase are constructed of grandfather rock, granite quarried from the nearby Grandfather Mountain region, and the exterior bark, siding, and interior wood paneling are of wormy chestnut, now nearly extinct in Appalachia. Guests enjoy a fireplace in each of the 11 rooms and three cottages. They're on Sunset Drive, ragged-gardens.com. Well, let's see. We have about 5 minutes left, so I'm going to go back here to page 62, which I have noted has a five-minute article. And this is called Armchair Odyssey. Accounts by European explorers who visited North Carolina centuries ago let us travel back to another era, but their words only tell part of the story. By T. Edward Nickens. The rain turns to sleet. It goes from a patter to a ping on the gutter outside, and I sink deeper into the sofa. For once, I heed the television meteorologist. I'm going nowhere. I put on a pot of coffee and tick through the possibilities. More email. Clean the basement. Do something about that sticky closet door. Nope, nope, and nope. It's days like this that set my mind to wondering, or wandering, about a particular passion. What was it like in North Carolina before there were sticky closet doors and gutter made of metal and auto-drip Java? The deep winter months seemed tailor-made for this sort of pondering. What was it like when the Tuscarora roamed this land, when the Saponi of the Yadkin Valley hunted elk in the lowlands, before European sails crested the horizon, before settlement, before the state was plotted and platted and plowed? What was North Carolina like before? There's nothing like sleet on a metal gutter to send me down this rabbit hole. On a bookcase in my office is a country mile dedicated to the earliest written notions of what would become North Carolina and southeastern colonies. There's the Juan Pardo expeditions, exploration of the Carolinas and Tennessee, 1566 to 1568. Nearby is Byrd's Line, a fascinating analysis of the surveyor William Byrd II's 1728 journey along the North Carolina-Virginia border. It's more riveting than any Marvel blockbuster, I promise. Keep on moving to the right. John Bannister in his Natural History of Virginia, 1678 to 1692. 1491, New Revelations of the Americas Before Columbus. Westward from Virginia, the exploration of Virginia-Carolina frontier, 1650 to 1710. There are works of William Bartram, Alexander Wilson, and Mark Catesby, the so-called colonial Audubon. And, of course, there's my favorite, the tattered and marked-up copy of A New Voyage to Carolina, the 1709 blockbuster of a North Carolina exploration written by John Lawson. So enamored am I of Lawson that I was determined to name my son Lawson Nickens until Julie vetoed it. Those double N's just don't work for me, she sniffed. This seems tangential, but it's the first time in 21 years that I've had the opportunity to complain about it in print, so please bear with me. It's a messy business, mustering to imagination what the recently retired Appalachian State University environmental historian Timothy Silver calls the elusive entity of a past landscape. Why, Silver's A New Face of the Countryside, Indians, Colonists, and Slaves in South Atlantic Forests, 1500 to 1800, hasn't hit Hollywood is beyond me. Read it now. Through time, North Carolina's landscape has been no more static than a heartbeat, changing with the centuries, the decades, the years, the months, the moments. To choose the arrival of Europeans as some sort of starting point is to disregard the millions of people who already inhabited the New World. Truth be told, there really was no before. There was only a continent that had long been under the tenure of one race of man and that was about to be invaded by another. In fact, much of the literature concerning North Carolina in the 17th and 18th centuries is colored with overstatements of the positive attributes of the region. Writers often had a vested interest in reporting to their patrons that the New World acreage was a wonderland. Some early reports were little more than glorified advertising, according to the late historian Hugh Talmage Loeffler, and hardly the sort of document that would hold up under scrutiny. The goodliest soil under the scope of heaven, Ralph Lane called the environs of Sir Walter Raleigh's first toehold on Roanoke Island, spawning a cloying phrase that would inspire real estate brochure writers for the next few centuries. In 1649, the Moderate Intelligencer, a weekly news sheet published in London, printed a two-page letter describing Carolina, the region south of the James River, in glowing terms. Now you see you're plentifully fed and clothed with the natural commodities of the country, which fall into your hands without labor or toil, for in the obtaining of them you have a delightful recreation. And that, my friends, is all the time we have for today. I hope you enjoyed this reading of Our State Magazine, and you'll listen again next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. The content of this magazine is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our State Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org, and on iTunes. If you have any comments or questions, please call us studios at 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.